Judy Darrah is known for her use of colour and for her use of found materials as a sculptor and a painter and a jeweller. Lots of plastic. Darrah has long reflected on how we treat the planet. An art teacher for much of her career. Last year, she received the Order of New Zealand Merit for her services to the arts, specifically as an advocate for other artists and the arts in general, and as well as a significant role in developing artist-run spaces. She recently co-founded an advocacy group called Arts Makers Aotearoa. She's appearing at Nelson Jewellery Week next month, and she's with me now. Kia ora.
Morena, Kim.
How nice to talk to you. You have chosen a lot of music for us this morning, and happily, it's chronological, so it can take us tunefully through your entire life, except your childhood, which remains music-free, apparently.
Yes. You Unfortunately, it was the Sound of Music soundtrack to my childhood.
Sound of Music, that's all right. You had a very interesting childhood for an artist, an intensely creative one, even though both your parents were very working class. And that sounds like a contradiction, but not back in that day, was it?
No. I mean, to be an artist, there was no artist in the family. I didn't really understand what art was. But my parents were makers. They were both incredibly productive. Dad was out in the shed fixing things. In those days, you never bought anything, you repaired it. My mum sewed all our clothes. You know, we had mother and daughter matching outfits right down to the dolls.
Did you?
It was a very creative home in a sense. So I guess that's where I observed this whole idea of making and creating. And then when I kind of went off and became an artist, I think it was quite difficult for my parents. I think they were worried because they couldn't see how can you live as an artist, and that's probably still true.
But you haven't had to, have you?
Well, I've taught, yes. So they were very happy that I was a teacher. So, you know,
respectable occupation.
Yes, right. Correct.
Mm. But they never objected to you being an artist. I suppose it just made them feel more comfortable that you had another income.
That's absolutely right. Yes, correct.
The fact that you didn't have to make a living out of it, has that been liberating?
Oh, absolutely, totally. I mean, I went through Wellington Polytech. I didn't go through the fine arts academic, that kind of pathway. So I didn't know what the rules were in a sense. So I came at art making in a very oblique way, and it gave me a lot of freedom. And the fact that, you know, I could explore a whole lot of different making and materials because I didn't have to sell it, or I could give it away or swap it, you know. So I was sort of working with a different currency, if you like, kind of outside the art world, but then sort of observing it and coming in as well.
How interesting. I mean, I wonder if you'd had to make a living out of it, what you would have been as an artist.
Well, for artists to sustain a practice, you need to have a very strong commercial base. So you have a relationship with a dealer and you have a relationship with collectors. So that's one way, and that's a very traditional way of sustaining yourself as a career through sales and being part of the market.
But then you have to give people what they want.
Well, yes.
Instead of suggesting to them that they don't know what they want, but try this.
Yes. Well, I did actually experiment with that. I did did a black and white framed work show, and it sold out. So I did prove that point. But I kind of felt like I wanted to be a bit more disruptive, I think. And, I used to hang around with artist-run spaces and all these kind of, I guess we wanted to rattle things a bit more, you know. We didn't want to sit back and just play this sort of the game of the dealer and that relationship. So, and there were lots of other ways to operate as artists, and I'm really interested in working collectively. So I've worked with lots of artist collectives, and that way you support each other as well. So that's not necessarily financial support, but more sort of a group supporting your practice and having conversations. And also, I've got a very supportive partner, and I think most artists in their lives would have, you need supportive family and because members of your family to support you as well. So, you know, we have to give that as well.
We've got a whole picture, a whole lot of pictures of your work on our webpage. Have you seen them? Do you know what we've got on our webpage?
No, I haven't seen them.
Okay. I mean, I will pick something at random and ask you about it. The first one is, it's called Artwork Untitled 2, which is really helpful. It's a sparkly thing in a pink wig.
Oh, is that a photograph?
Yes.
Yes, so that's a plastic bottle that I've covered in tin foil and then put a pink wig on and then I got an experienced professional photographer, Sam, to shoot it against some fluoro paper. So it's kind of a portrait. It looks like some sort of strange, surrealist portrait head. So I'm sort of playing around with that idea of portraiture and surrealism and this whole kind of synthetic, if you like, found objects, kind of tacky, kind of bright, a bit scratchy, you know, how sometimes that's those wigs look a bit itchy and scratchy.
Yeah.
So you get quite a visceral response to it.
Yeah.
And it's plastic. And I'm kind of pushing this plastic barrel. I've been doing it for a while now because a lot of my scavenging, I'm going into op shops and hospice shops and just seeing mountains and mountains of plasticware, discarded plasticware, you know, and that, when you look at it, that's a material that comes from the earth. That's a petrochemical that we take out of the earth, transform into this plastic material, and then we don't know what to do with it. And now it's a problem.
But so you're saving it?
I'm sort of drawing attention to it. It's a problem, and I'm trying to identify it as a problem. We're addicted to plastic, let's face it. We can't stop making it. We make it bright. We make it shiny. It looks like lollies. We want to touch it. It's smooth. It's all these things that are very visceral and very materially touchable for us. So we need to think about, well, okay, do we need so much plastic? Yes, we do, because there's a lot of cultures where plastic is a very affordable material, you know, the plastic chairs that they can carry around, etc. So it is a useful material. But what do we do with it after we've discarded it? And I think that's the issue is, okay, so what I'm doing is coming along and taking it out of that cycle and drawing attention to these bits of recycled plastic. And, you know, I use them in a work and then I bring them back to my studio, pull it apart, and then I put it back into the whole recycling through the op shop again. So I'm sort of highlighting it and then putting it back, if you like.
You send it back to the op shop?
I do, yeah. These are works that kind of end up back at my studio, yeah.
Your home is a bit of a gallery in itself, isn't it?
Yes, well, Grant and I are both collectors, so... Well, part of my making is going out and finding stuff, materials and collecting, and sometimes I find a gem that I can't use in a work, so that might end up on a shelf, and then you get one of them and then you find another one, and then next minute you've got a whole Siamese cat collection, and next minute you've got, you know, a collection. Grant works on film, so, you know, he can sometimes gets these amazing objects and props, you know, which are too good to give away. And everything has a story. I mean, all these objects that come into our house has a story. It's part of our history and part of our lives. So it's a kind of a museum, if you like, as well.
You've both got Order of New Zealand Merit, haven't you?
I'm an officer.
Oh, you're an officer?
And Grant's a member.
Oh.
Yeah, nah. Oh.
That's pretty good.
I trumped him.
Yeah, well done. Your first track takes you back to the 70s. This is Joan Armatrading, Down to Zero. A lot of people will remember this. What were you doing at the time?
So I'd left home, living in Wellington, flatting at Polytech, discovering freedom as a, you know, 18, 19-year-old. And then a gang of us went to this concert. It was one of her first, I think it was probably the first time she'd come to New Zealand, and the song had just been released, and we're at the old town hall, and it was just this magical evening. It was her on the stage with a stark light shining on her playing, and she was wearing white, and it was like this vision playing this song, and we were transformed. You know how a powerful song can transform you, and that was definitely a moment I remember, yeah.
Joan, I'm a trading. I'm talking to Judy Darrah. I talked to Joan, I'm a trading not so long ago. She had a new album out.
Wow, lucky you.
Well, yeah, and she's lovely. But so influential was she back in those days that we won't let her sort of move on. She'll never be as great as she was then. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think it's that first time, you know, it's the first time you experience something and... Yeah, that was a song about, you know, heartbreak. I mean, how extraordinary, you know, being dumped and feeling like you're down to zero, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we all experienced that.
Yes.
In our youth.
Yes.
You have, of course, famously been called the Queen of Kitsch, and there was a very nice book, actually, called Judy Dara, So You Made It, which came out to coincide with a big Te Papa exhibition of yours in 2004. And it says that you long abdicated that throne. At what point did you abdicate the throne, and did you like sitting in it?
It was interesting because the word kitsch is, you know, problematic. You embrace it or you find it problematic. It was never a problem for me because I relished in the fact that, you know, I was using plastic flowers and Christmas lights and all of this stuff, which was sort of disrupting, I guess, a narrative around what you put in an art gallery. And so I can't remember where that came from. I think it must have been probably a review or something.
I think it was a program.
Oh, maybe, yes.
I think it was some kind of profile television program.
That's right.
When they used to do the arts.
When they used to do the arts on the media.
Yes, yeah. Remember when. and I think that was the title, The Queen of Kitsch.
That's right, you are right.
Did you mind?
No, because, look, I am really all about getting art being talked about generally beyond the art community. So if we can put art everywhere and if, you know, someone can talk about art beyond that on the radio or on the TV, fabulous. You know, we need to, art needs to be like an everyday part of our lives, not something that sits outside it. So I embraced it. I went with it. And then I ended up at Melbourne at Queen's College doing a residency. And I went, oh, my God, this is too much. So I decided to abdicate while I was in Melbourne. And also it was kind of getting a bit claustrophobic in terms of discussions around my work. You know, people would only read it as kitsch and not think beyond it. I mean, kitsch is a bit more complex. You know, it's overloaded. It's extravagant, it's political. So I think I just had to remove it from my work so I could have another conversation around the work as well.
It's sentimental is the word that most people attach to kitsch.
Yes, sentimental and a bit syrupy and therefore easily dismissed.
Mm.
But then also again, perhaps, is it too feminine? I mean, is it, you know, too much? So... and I think also I was moving away from those materials as well. I mean, the materials are problematic in that, you know, like who's going to buy a whole lot of plastic Christmas lights and they're all going to go kafit, you know, in 10 years, you know. So the work, a lot of my work doesn't last, which I don't mind. It's a problem for institutions collecting and conservators, you know. So I don't mind that. I kind of like the fact that the work does disappear. You know, we've got books and writing and images of work, you know, and that's how I learnt all about art was looking at art books, black and white images from Gombrich in the old days, you know. I mean, that was my experience of art. So I guess, I think the kitsch thing became, something that held the work back, yeah.
I'm looking at a text which says, could you please tell Judy Dara that after seeing her giant limbo sculpture at Auckland Art Gallery a couple of years ago, both my kids came home and immediately demanded we go to the supermarket to get tinfoil and then spend the afternoon making tinfoil rocks to paint and then from our windows, inspiration right there, I don't know. What would they have done? Put them in the windows to paint and then from our windows?
Maybe hung them up. Fabulous. Look at that.
Hung from our windows.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go that way.
Tinfoil.
So there you are.
Yeah.
You've influenced a generation.
Tinfoil artists.
Yeah. I'm looking at this book, Judy Dara, So You Made It, which is such a great title, actually, because it goes to the materiality and the DIY thing, as well as... the success thing. I like it.
Mm.
And there's this essay by Chris Kras called Fat Cheesy Slut. And
it's got, fabulous.
Yeah. It's got this great picture of one of your pieces, The Birth of Barbie, which you made in 1989. I mean, that's a, You went through a shrine period. Is that one of your shrines?
Yes, yes. That's one of the first shrine works. I'd been to China and I'd seen a lot of, you know, the little shrines they have all around the place?
Yeah.
You know, in the car parks and things. And, you know, I mean, I was brought up a Catholic, and so I know what a shrine is. You know, I'm all over that embellishment and that theatre. So I just kind of like that idea of a little personal shrine or a shrine to something. What does that mean? I did one for Gaia. I did one for Mother Earth. I did... And the Barbie one is sort of a kick to, you know, birth of Venus, birth of Barbie, contemporary woman, etc. Now, that work got bought by John Matthews and his wife and ended up in their gallery in New Plymouth. And they had a tragic fire and lost their amazing art collection. And that one went down in the fire. So
there's no more.
Yes.
Wow.
Mm.
You could make it again.
Well, I did. I actually remade it. Yes, John wanted it again, another version, so I remade it. But of course, it was very different because the materials were different. But yeah, he was a great art supporter, patron too.
Hell to Dust.
Yes. Yes.
I always think that.
Yes.
When I look at chandeliers, I think Hell to Dust.
Yes. I don't dust. I've never dusted.
Have you not?
No, it's overrated.
Well, also, you've got too much stuff going on to dust.
Yeah, just don't disturb it.
Oh, and it doesn't show up.
Yeah.
All right, I'll bear that in mind. I just, you know, feel that you do it, and then a year later it needs to be done again. It's just terrible. I'm looking at another picture of your work. It's called Mesh. This is on our website. Mesh 1. Is that from the exhibition where you stuff stockings with things?
Yes, so that was an object space show called Competitive Plastics. Is that the one where it's black stockings and there's plastic objects in it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Competitive Plastics was a real name of a real company in Christchurch.
Yes, around from my gallery in Jonathan Smart. And I used to walk around there and I love this idea of plastic competing. that's black net stockings, but ooh la la. And then I've put a whole lot of colourful plastic objects in them. And so they're slightly droopy and pendulous looking.
Yeah, they are. I think these ones look like trumpets in some way. But anyway, I get the general impression. Somebody has said, using plastic for art doesn't reduce the amount of plastic in the world, it simply glamorizes it. What do you say to that?
I think what I'm trying to do is highlight the amount of it. I'm trying to present it as a problem. So you see all this plastic and you go, oh, it's icky, or it's, oh, look at it. You know, so you're actually responding to it in a way. I think I'd like to see it more as a highlighting the problem, not so much glamorizing. I mean, it is seductive. There is some beauty in it. And also...
Even the word sounds like it is. It's quite onomatopoeic, I always think. Plastic.
Mm. And it means fluid, doesn't it? Mm. You know, like it's something fluid that's made solid and it's modern. You know, remember when plastics first were part of our industrial scene? It was really cool. You know, plastics here and plastics there, it was really contemporary. And next minute we've created a huge problem with it, you know, like a lot of things we've done and are doing.
Your next track actually deals with that. It goes back to 1989. It's the Pixies. And it's their very prescient, really, Monkey Gone to Heaven, because it's talking about things that are all too present now. Where were you when you were listening to this?
So I think I was teaching at Metropolitan College in those days. And
that was the alternative college.
Yes. ERO came in and didn't approve and slowly shut the place down. But it was an extraordinary, for me as a teacher, to be in this environment where it was basically a school run by the students, and it was really good for me politically to be in this kind of environment and see how, I guess, an idealistic democracy was working or didn't work. And I was living in an Anzac Ave in those days in a big warehouse, and there was no one living in the city, and it was full of, I guess, punks and skinheads. It was very tribal in those days. And I just had this sort of, it was post-punk, or it was sort of rebellious, and this song was like an anthem, you know. It was a warning, if you like, about, you know, burning, you know, the planet burning. It was kind of one of the first environmental songs, I think. That
everything is going to burn, they sing.
Yes, that's right.
There was a guy. An underwater guy who controlled the sea. Got killed by 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey.
The Pixies, Monkey Gone to Heaven, Judy Darrah. Pick that track. Now, you're going to be at Nelson Jewellery Week next month. Has jewellery always been part of your practice?
Yeah, I think it has, actually.
See, I don't know what jewellery is anymore.
No, well, it's something that you plonk on the body, you know.
But sometimes it's not even. Sometimes it's not even wearable.
That's right. It's it could be an extension of the body. It could be something separate from the body. I think that's why a lot of contemporary jewellery now sort of slips into, I guess, more sculptural practice as well, which I find really interesting. You know, there's a bit of a blurring of the line going on when you think of someone like Lisa Walker and her amazing output. So I'm all over that kind
of... Who's also into plastic.
Yes.
Very, in a big way, found yes, plastic.
Yes.
Last
yes.
I saw.
I must still swap. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're all makers, eh? We're all makers. We all make things with our hands, and we just call it something different, or we just put it somewhere different. And I kind of, that's for me, is more interesting. And I did a bit of work with the Handshake Project, which Peter Deckers runs, which is part of the Jewellery Week. And they do this really great mentoring project where they get young jewellers and they ask the jewellers who they want as their mentees, and I did a couple with some jewellery. So it was really great for me to talk to jewellers and about their practice, because there's a lot of common stuff that we can talk about, just about generally making and how we make, etc. So, there's a lot of crossovers, yeah.
There's a rather gorgeous piece of jewellery that we have in our webpage, and it looks like somebody's mother's costume jewellery enhanced, and it's got a little label on it saying Dog's Dinner. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so that's a little range I do called Dog's Dinner. And for me, they're just fun. They're like drawing or, you know, just something really easy to make. And it's basically clear silicone, and I just stick in all this sort of jewels and gems and recycled jewellery. And, yeah, they're very large and they're quite heavy. So you have to wear them on a wool coat. So there's quite a few rules around them. But they're just sort of, very much looking at the whole idea of jewellery being sort of over the top and just very excessive.
There are very few places that you can learn to be a jeweller in New Zealand now, I think.
Oh, Kim, it is heartbreaking. So when I started teaching at Manukau Polytech, that was the jewellery school, was the base of that visual art school. And I remember these amazing women who'd been there for years teaching jewellery. The art school got absorbed into that. Then MIT, that finished, that art school disappeared. Nelson Jewellery School, I think, is pretty much shut down. And I was talking to Olivia Cook, who works down at Dunedin, and I think their jewellery school was about to go because they're uneconomic. And it's just heartbreaking, all these schools.
Fitzroy,
yeah. So what's going to happen? We're going to have a skipper generation where these skills aren't being taught.
Well, I suppose that's what makes these handshake projects and the mentoring project all the more important. Not a complete substitute, but important, right?
Yes, and the Jewellery Week, because it keeps the jewellers coming together, and they come from all around New Zealand. And these collaborations with English jewellers and Melbourne jewellers. So it's really important to keep that conversation going. And, you know, jewellery, I guess it's expensive. You have to have workshops, you have to have technicians. It's not a lecture theatre with 300 people in it, you know. And I think generally the visual arts are getting hammered across universities for those same reasons, as they're just too expensive to run. Yeah, so we're a little bit broken at the moment, I feel, just in terms of moving ahead in this new world, in terms of how the arts are going to be supported or valued. There's quite a bit going on at the moment as well around that.
You're talking presumably about Auckland Council, apart from anything else.
Yes, the Stop the Cuts. We got very involved with it with Arts Makers, and everyone got together to get the message. We're on the same page. It's being an artist is precarious enough without having these kind of, rumblings in the background. And even though it's not much, it may not appear much, for the arts community, we are lean and we're mean, and any cut is a big slice, you know.
Do you think that Wayne Brown does not think that art matters?
I'm not sure. I think there might be a lot of misunderstanding about what art is or what an arts community is. It's not just paintings on the wall. It is a community of people who come together for, workshops, for conversations, for sharing of knowledge, passing down knowledge. It's not just simply, one model, which is the painting on the wall. It's about well-being and people. You know, when you make art, I get a hit of dopamine. That's why I do it. I just feel so good when I'm in my studio.
Yeah, that's nice for you,
Yeah.
And everybody's happy about that. Mm. However, the government has ditched climate change policies because of the cost of living.
Mm.
Wayne Brown is about to ditch, who knows what he's about to ditch, because people won't be able to afford the rates if he keeps them on. That's the argument. Now, whether you feel good in your studio or not is neither here nor there, is it?
Well, it's good for my well-being. And, I mean, God, who doesn't need to feel good at the moment?
No, well, that's quite true. Yeah. But you need, you know, there's, and I presume you're going to tell me there's a halo effect and you feeling good makes other people feel good. And that's fine. It's intangible is the problem.
Yeah, so, well, I think it's an attitude. And, you know, like Wellington put the rates up. And they said, we're keeping intact events, arts and culture. So that's a value statement. So I don't know. I mean, maybe we're in a time now where things are changing and we're looking at a lot of priorities. I don't know. I mean, it's the new world, like I said before, and it's all quite unknown.
Mm. I'm looking at another picture we've got in a bit. Website, it's called Binwork, and it looks like it's a bin and a wire bin with what looks like a watermelon-y thing in it.
Oh yeah, I did a series of rubbish bin works, so they're net, you know, office rubbish bins, yeah. Which I'd kind of squash something in, like whether it was a picture or an object, and they could be hung on the wall. So I guess it's about that when you chuck something away in anger or something, or it's just sort of a funny, they're meant to be quite light and humorous, you know, you put a rubbish tin on the wall and some frustration there, you know, where you can, they were good to make actually because I could squash the bins, it was fun.
There are lots of beautiful things in our photos of your work actually, and quite elaborate carousel, for example, where you've got a beach umbrella and you've got things hanging from it and you've got draped bits coming off it. It's lovely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. There's also another thing I'm really aware of more than ever is that art has to give something, you know, like joy or make you smile. And I guess it's part of the conversation I was having before about how, you know, what art should be doing, I guess, is providing the viewer with some kind of relief or joy or something, you know, and we're in that stage now. Like I went to Ruben Patterson's exhibition opening down in Wellington and people were just smiling, yeah, and joyous, and kids were lying down next to the panther and the bear, and you know, it was really heartening.
Yeah, I mean, art also wants to say something meaningful and serious about society, but you would put joy ahead of that.
And humour, and then you can get some dark stuff in later maybe, you know. I think when you view an artwork, it's not just a one-dimensional thing, you know. You look at it, you stop, you see something, you might stay a bit longer, you might see something else. It sort of unravels in front of you. So I think you can do all those things, if you like, at the same time. And I think, look, I think we've just been through a global relational aesthetic artwork where everyone around the world queued 2 metres away from each other. And I think we're done, you know. That was a performance piece in itself. Mm.
Somebody has texted me to say, I remember Judy's wonderful shop, The Blue Room. I have an orange Pacific Heart artwork of hers, made of plastic flowers that glows. One of my most favourite things. I have to keep gluing the petals back on, but that is part of its appeal. And that must make your heart sing. However, if your work is being bought in, you know, by a museum, for example, Te Papa, is there a problem with conserving it, given that it's made out of ephemeral materials?
Absolutely. Okay. It's a conservator's nightmare. I mean, a lot of my work doesn't even get passed onto their desk. But I'll tell you what, a nice thing that did happen was there was a work called Rock and Rose Bed, which was plastic rocks and plastic roses from the 80s. And it was a polystyrene bed. It was at Art Space, old Art Space in Queen Street. and then Key Street in the old days, and I'd glued plastic rocks and roses. So it was rock and rose bed, you know, I want to make your marriage, your life a bed of roses and a rocky marriage. So it was all this sort of metaphor and playing around with relationships. Mm. Anyway, the work came back and I took all the plastic rocks and flowers off and put them in plastic bags under my desk. And then, Dennis Cohen said, oh, look, I want you to remake that Rock and Rose Bend. I'm going to donate it to the Auckland City Art Gallery. So I thought, oh, this is the only way my work's going to get into collections, if people donate it. So that work is sitting there at the moment, which comes out every now and then. So that was a nice roundabout way of getting it past the line.
Yeah, yeah. I want to play this next track because it's lovely, apart from anything else, not given lightly. But I mentioned The Blue Room, and this song takes you back to the time when you opened The Blue Room in West Lynn in Auckland with Sarah McKenney.
Yes, that's right. She was a ceramicist, and I took all my plastic objet and we painted it blue, painted the inside blue. We were open 2 days a week, had to be quick. And it was very sleepy there. There was tumbleweed would come through. But Chris and Barbara, Chris Knotts, live around the back. And so they'd always come by on a Saturday or Sunday. And then we'd have these like little openings where you, and Chris would come around with his guitar and sing. And it was really lovely. We had a really lovely time there. And then I remember Chris was doing Here We Go, a TV arts program, New Artland, and he was the narrator on those as well. And I think that was probably one of the most, the end or the last of the most significant, you know, TV-focused arts programs, I think. Yeah, it would have been.
Wow. It's astonishing to think that they used to have arts programs on television, isn't it?
Do you remember Kaleidoscope?
Yeah.
Thanks for the days.
Here's Chris Knox.
Hello, my friend. It's morning. Time to wake now. Your body and mind entwined, will have to break now. But I want your flesh, your warmth to stay beside me. Oh, how I wish you could be deep inside me. Show me your eyes, your love, most tender feeling. Mind, be truthful and revealing, cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love. It's love not given lightly, but I knew this was love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. When we're alone, I cannot always face you. Maybe my mood won't let these arms embrace you. That doesn't mean my love somehow diminished. Give me the time to show our love's unfinished. Cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love, and it's love not given lightly. But I knew this was a love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. I need your body, your mind, and your emotions. Shed me your tears till I drown in your oceans. Cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love. It's love not given lightly, but I knew this was love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. Say the words, destroy our meaning. It's only cliche. Leisha's mother. This isn't easy. I might not write another, but it's you that I love, and it's true that I love, and it's more than what it might be. And I knew this was a love, and it's you that I love, and it's love not given lightly, 'cause it's you that I love.
Chris Knox, Not Given Lightly, a song much loved over the years. I'm talking to Judy Dara. I love that song. I almost don't mind that it was used for the bread advertisement. Artists have to earn a crust, if you'll excuse the pun. One of the most recent works that you've done is Pecking Order, in which you used lists that you found, shopping lists, that you found, discarded lists around the trolley areas of supermarkets. Can you talk to me about that?
Oh, yes. So that was a lockdown work. I actually didn't think I was actually making any work over lockdown. And I'd go to the supermarkets and I'd see, which was unusual, a whole lot of people's shopping lists would all be strewn around. You know, clearly people weren't cleaning up as much and there'd be shopping lists in the in the trolleys, and so I thought, oh, these are really good. I started collecting them up, and because there'd be funny little, you know, sometimes kids would add stuff like exploding kittens or quite funny, and then you'd also get a sense of what people were eating. And there's a classic one, which was wine, tissues, toilet paper. And I think that probably summed up lockdown.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started collecting these, and then at the same time I was feeding the birds. I was throwing all the bread out, and I was going, oh, my God, these are some really interesting shapes they were making, like depending on what sort of bread I was putting out. And like tortillas, it would be little pecks all around the edges. So it was like lace. And then others, they would only eat the insides, not the crust. So I was getting these great shapes. So I would start to intervene and pull the bread away from the birds and then go, oh, that's a good one, I'll keep that. And then got them photographed and enlarged. And then I put the images of the photographs of the shopping lists along with the bread images, so you get this idea of pecking in order. And it was, I guess it was just a moment of lockdown, looking at birds, feeding birds, and these are now huge enlarged photographs at Christchurch Art Gallery in their show Perilous, which is this amazing show, everyone go and see it, from their collection.
One of the I was going to say most structured pieces that we have of yours on the website. I don't know whether structured is the word you would use. It's called Please Touch. And it's a, you know, a square within a circle within a square. And it looks like it's made of felt, is it?
Oh, yes, that was foam. Yes, felt. I found them. I was doing a residency in San Francisco, and they have really good hardware shops there and craft shops. And they were like big, giant felt sticky things that you put on your table legs to not scratch the floor.
Oh, yeah.
And they reminded me of, you know, that tradition of, you know, Boyce, Joseph Boyce using felt and that material and stuff. But I love this sort of industrial thing of them. And then the target. So they sort of became, I guess, you know, little nods to the contemporary art, you know, art practice of the target and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and that was an invitation to touch because...
And people do?
Well... But we're not allowed to touch, no, so it was sort of a, yeah.
So if I saw that hanging on a wall called Please Touch, I would touch it.
Yes, but you'd probably get told off.
Yeah.
It's a paradox.
That's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to play one more track because it's really good. Somebody else, I think it was Ebony Lamb, who chose this track a while ago. It's Karen Dalton, who has become more famous posthumously than during her really hard life. There was a documentary that came out a couple of years ago about her life. When did you first hear her?
I was introduced to her by some musician friends, and it must have been just before the doco, and I was just swept away. It was just the voice of this crackling, it was almost like a musical instrument. And and then I kind of dug more into her life and realized how hard her life had been, and just incredible musician. Yeah,
pregnant and married at 16.
Yes.
And at 21 she left her husband and the two children. She went off to New York, and there was depression and addiction and poverty, but she made this kind of music. It's been lovely talking to you, Judy Darrah. Thank you very much for your time. Here is Karen Dalton with Something on Your Mind.
Yesterday